Hey there, listener. This is Adam of the Dollar Band. You're currently listening to a Dollar Band presentation of the Heroes Con 2010 panel,
Family Friendly Comics, moderated by Dollar Band's own Brian Eisen.
I'd like to take this moment to welcome you to our little corner of the internet. For those of you encountering us for the first time, the Dollar Band is a weekly comic book podcast focused mainly on discussion and debate by a rotating cast of comic book fans and professionals. If excitable debate is not for you, may I offer a choice of our most educational interviews with professionals across the industry, from writers and artists to editors and shop owners. Thanks, and come back often.
What I'd like to do is get everybody to kind of introduce themselves, and then we'll get started. So,
Mr. Schweitzer, would you like to start?
Hi, I'm Chris Schweitzer. I'm down at in the 400 block of Indy Island. I'm not sure exactly which one, but I have a red tablecloth.
You're a 432.
I'm 432. Thank you. Sorry, a little out of breath from the run-up. I do the Krogan Adventure Series for Oni Press. It's a series of historical adventures. Each book is a different member of this family tree at different points throughout history. So the first one was pirates. The second one is the French Foreign Legion. Sorry. The one I'm working on right now is the American Revolution. They come out roughly once a year.
Hi, I'm Roger Langridge. I work on the Muppet Show comic book, which I write and draw. And I'm also doing, I'm writing an all-ages Thor comic for Marvel at the moment.
And you can find Roger at AA518 this weekend.
I'm Mark Wade. I'm the editor-in-chief of Boom Studios and Boom Kids Comics. So I'm, we're doing the Pixar material with Boom, with Toy Story and Incredibles and Cars and a ton of other stuff. And we're also doing the Muppet material and couldn't be happier. So I'm at the Boom booth, either of the Boom booths right there at what aisle, like way up near the front. Aisle near up the front.
Like that. I think it's 516 or something.
You sir. I'm Franco. I work on Tiny Titans and Billy Batson and the Magic of Shazam for DC Comics.
Yeah.
I see a fan already.
Yeah, cool.
And I'm at one of the booths somewhere.
You're at 226.
Yes.
MLA 226.
My name is Jamie Cosley, and I get Franco water and sandwiches. I've worked with Art and Franco for years, and I do an online comic, Nobody Likes Tony Pony, about an office furniture salesman.
Oh. Kids love office furniture salesmen.
You'd be surprised.
I know.
How much furniture he moves.
I imagine.
With that shirt.
I used to work at a furniture store.
Did you really?
Yeah, kids on all the time.
And when he's not bringing Franco sandwiches, he's sitting next to him.
Yeah.
Right. You sit in those chairs and you spin.
Yep. Yeah. I'm Chris Giarrusso. I was the writer and artist of the Mini Marvels, and I'm currently the writer and artist of G-Man, Little Kid Superhero Fun.
Yay. Yay.
My name's not really important, but just in case you were curious.
Well, I'm an artist at LA Table 512.
Sorry. My name is Brian. I'm with the website that is helping with the sound and recording some of the panels this weekend. It's called thedollarbin.net. So if you'd like to relive this panel, you can listen to it on our website. And I also am a comics manager for a comic shop in Columbia, South Carolina. Cool. So actually, I asked to do this panel from Heroes, which is kind of a tradition at Heroes, because I really like to order and push all ages comics.
Great.
With that in mind, kind of the first thing that I wanted to start with is comics, there used to be kind of these called kids comics, and that became kind of a not so buzzword with the industry.
Yeah.
And the term all ages came about. And what I wanted each of you to maybe start off with is, who is your target audience when you're writing, the core books that you're in charge of, as far as like for Roger for the Muppets, Chris obviously for his Krogan's Adventures, Mark like when you're doing the Incredibles,
right.
And a Tiny Titans, G-Man, things of that nature. Do you shoot for a particular age range? How do you judge what's all ages to the creator?
I shoot for an adult age range. I write to try and make it the book that I would most. That would be my first choice if I went into a comic shop and picked it up, subject matter-wise, content-wise, things like that. But in order to make it all ages, I simply make sure that there's nothing in it that I would find objectionable to kids. To be better suited, that my parents would not have found objectionable for me to have read when I was, 7 to 8 years old. Because I think that a big thing with comics
is that through the context of words and pictures, kids have a reading comprehension with comics that they can never really have with prose, with which they're unfamiliar, because you can look at the facial expressions, you can look at the body language, you can look at what's going on, and there can be, you know, 8 words in a row that they won't understand, but because of what they're seeing, they're better equipped to process those words, and I think that it helps with that vocabulary and reading comprehension. But it also, there's no reason, I mean, like, who here read Calvin and Hobbes, who's young enough, who read Calvin and Hobbes when they were a little kid? And did any of you have any problems, like, processing it? He's using, like, 9-syllable words in there, but it still reads fine, and I think that's something that, I think with the kids' comic movement that came before the all-ages comics, that was something that was sort of neglected. There was this idea of writing for kids specifically, and I think kids tend to gravitate towards stuff that's written at an adult level, but is safe for kids, and so that's what I try to do.
Yeah, I pretty much write for myself, because my heroes, my all-ages comic artist heroes, like Carl Barks, did pretty much the same thing. They wrote for themselves and then just left out anything that might be dodgy for a parent, you know, that might sort of raise alarms.
Alaskan kidnapping scenes.
Yeah. So that's pretty much what I do. I just write something for myself, but leave out any swearing, any nudity, any extreme violence, which I wouldn't do anyway, really. It's not really my concern. And it seems to work. You know, I'm in a privileged position, I guess, in that I'm working on a licensed property and I've got other people keeping an eye on the content for me. So if I cross a line, somebody's going to pull me back. So I don't really have to think about it too hard, you know. I know somebody's sort of got my back on that in that regard.
Yeah, my answer is slightly... The answer of Mark Wade, the editor-in-chief, is slightly different than the answer to Mark Wade, the freelance writer, which is, as the writer, I side with these guys. I mean, I write primarily to make myself happy and make myself laugh and make myself entertain first, with an idea, again, towards... Like, I've read, you know, 30,000 comic books. The language is ingrained in me. I sort of, like, it's in my DNA what you can and can't do for an all-ages comic. I don't think I would, like you, I wouldn't even really be interested in doing stuff that is deliberately age inappropriate with these characters. It just would feel wrong. So, but I don't, most writers and artists, I think, really don't consider their audience first and foremost when they sit down to create. They just want to entertain themselves, and with the idea that if I make it interesting to me, then hopefully other people will be interested in it too. Otherwise, it comes off as sort of like calculated and shallow, like you're trying desperately to reach a demographic that you don't understand. As the editor-in-chief, I you know, I'm a little more aware and cognizant of the fact that we're shooting for a specific age breakdown. I mean, with the Pixar and stuff in particular, obviously, we're looking at anywhere from 4 to 10 or 11 years old, because that's a part of the market that, as we've set up here, is just traditionally in the last 20 years has not been served well, if at all. And I continue to be flabbergasted every day that, and gratefully so, that these books has performed as well as they have and they've been as successful as they have, like beyond our wildest dreams. I mean, when Ross Ritchie, who's the publisher, came to me with the idea that we'd be doing these books about 2.5 years ago, I patted him on the head and I said, "That's awesome. I guess I better keep Marvel on my speed dial, because this stuff doesn't work." And lo and behold, those books ordered in and have been selling consistently at about twice what I ever would have predicted. And that just proved they're hungry for good kids material out there. That's a really long answer, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Mark wholeheartedly. I'm in a unique position where I'm writing two different books for DC. One is Tiny Titans, which is honestly an all-ages book. And the way we approach it, the best way I can explain it is, you ever watch Bugs Bunny when you were a kid? And you're like, wow, that's really funny. And then you watch it as an adult, and you're like, hey, that's pretty funny. Because it's a whole different context. So that's exactly what we're going with for Tiny Titans. And you know, we've been just amazed with the response, too. I mean, you know, we were on the New York Times bestseller list with the first trade, and we won the Eisner, and no one was more surprised than I was when that happened. With Billy Batson, it's just, you know, a straight superhero story. And if you ask me if that's written for kids, I don't write it for kids. You know, Captain Marvel, you know, he's going to go around and beat up bad guys, and that's what we're writing. And that it falls into that age group where... You know, kids like it, And that's what we're going for. So, and most, you know, like these guys said, I write for myself.
Yeah.
If it makes me laugh or it's a good story, that's what we go with.
Yeah. Sure.
I usually write things and run it by my 8-year-old boy. And oftentimes if I get invited like to schools, and if I come to his school, he'll say, "Daddy, please don't bring this certain book because it's too weird." So he really helps rein me in. But I mean, everybody's right. You have to write for yourself first, and then that love and that passion, and that's what's great about these guys. I mean, I was fortunate enough to watch them for a decade work. I mean, I kind of liken it to like when some of these musicians are out and they're just selling their albums out of their cars, and that's what Art and Franco did. And they've always really been kid friendly, and that passion comes out.
I didn't give him his money now because he's going to keep this up the whole time.
But you brought up something interesting, Chris. Do you have kids?
No.
Okay. So it's a bit. But I know you've got what, 4 and 7, right? So
yeah, well, not 4 kids and 7 kids.
So just curious.
He's got to write some more books.
Do you ever use them as a litmus test? Do you ever run stuff by them just to see if it feels right for them? Not in terms of censorship, but just in terms of like, just do you ever use them as a test audience? I guess.
At the moment, they're not that into comics. Yeah. My daughter's having sort of some reading difficulties at the moment. She's still getting to grips with English, in fact, because she's bilingual in French. She's quite sort of fluent in, but and my son's sort of pre-reading, so they're not actually into comics at the moment.
All right.
But they like the idea of it. They love the idea of comics, yeah. You know. My son's actually starting to draw his own comics.
Cool.
Even though he's 4, so that's...
That's great.
You know, that's pretty amazing, because I started when I was 6, so he's 2 years ahead of me.
Anybody else up here?
I have a kid, but my wife continually reminds me that I act like a 5-year-old. So mentally, I guess I'm right at that age level where I can write this stuff easily. So, yeah.
So you are the kid that you run it by.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
What about you, Chris? What's your target audience?
Well, when I started doing work at Marvel, when I started the mini Marvels, I was just thinking I wanted to do newspaper style comic strips. And that's what I was doing, basically 3-4 panels. And when I was a kid, it was like every adult would read the newspaper comic strip, so it never occurred to me that that was necessarily a kid's audience. It wasn't inappropriate for kids, and it was the only part of the paper I wanted to read. And then at a certain point, it just became like people would start saying like, "Oh yeah, you know, that's the only thing I can show my kid," because the rest of the comics had gotten so mature and dark in ways that weren't really accessible to new readers or kids. So I was just, you know, writing for me, and it just turned out that it was the type of thing that everybody could understand and get into. The only change I ever really had to make was, I guess there's no smoking allowed in comics anymore, and I had drawn J. Jonah Jameson.
At least with Marvel.
And which is funny because, like, those books are so mature, but there's no smoking allowed.
Yeah, I know.
Only adults are buying those books.
I know.
A lot of them.
We don't want to corrupt those impressionable 28-year-olds.
That's right. And so when they reprinted one of my stories, I changed all of J. Jonah Jameson's cigars into lollipops.
So Wolverine can slice somebody in half.
Yeah, but he can't smoke a cigar.
He can't smoke a cigar.
That
might give somebody nightmares. Yeah. The cigar.
That's, you know, and it's funny. That's like, as somebody who's worked all over the industry, in different roles and stuff, I can kind of make a case for that. I wouldn't do it as the editor in chief, but I respect Joe Quesada, and I understand why you do that for J. Jonah Jameson and the hero characters. What makes me insane is that if you're the vilest villain in the world and you're smoking a cigarette, you know, no one, that's not an endorsement in any straight, you know, no one is going to come away from that going, "I want to be like Dr. Light."
Well, also, when I grow up.
You know,
the J. Jonah Jameson thing. I mean, like, a Wolverine I can understand because, you know, role model. But what kid wants to grow up to be J. Jonah Jameson?
No, but he's on the. I'm
the other way around.
Yeah.
Clearly, first off, you've never met Ross.
That's true. Yeah.
Also, you've never met Ross Ritchie. Clearly, yeah. But and he's on the side of the Angels.
That's true.
You guys are kind of touching on a interesting subject, and that's content. And you know, none of you, except you know, from Mark, from a publishing standpoint, are really necessarily gearing your comics towards anybody other than this is the kind of thing that I would like to write and read. Do you have, from a publishing standpoint, cutoff points where you've wanted to maybe put something in and they wanted to kind of pull you back a little bit because reminded you this is an all ages sort of a thing? Or are you just all just naturally nicer than all the other comic book creators and geared towards happier things?
I had what I thought was a really funny scene where an old lady is punched in the face. And it wasn't meant to be like violent. It was supposed to be like comical. And yeah, and I showed it to, because it's like this, it's a sort of Dudley Do-Right character that does it. And so it's sort of the context was to try and make that funny. And I showed it to my wife and she was like, no, you can't do that. And I showed it to my friend Hunter and then I showed it to my editor and they were all like, no, you gotta figure something out. So she gets her nose honked instead, which works just as well. But my biggest thing is that from a, their historical standpoints, they're adult characters. And so while there's a lot of violence, but it's generally off panel inferred violence. I figure age-appropriate violence, but I do have characters, never the protagonists. I do cut it at the protagonists because they're like younger. But I have a lot of side characters like smoking pipes and occasionally drinking, because if it's a pirate book, you know, they're going to be doing that in the background, yeah. You know. And I know that like Bone recently had a lot of library flack or school library flack for the tavern scenes where the characters are smoking pipes in the background. But I don't feel like that's something I can remove and still remain true to the time period. And also, you know, from an acting standpoint, you know, there's a reason all the actors in the 40s smoked. It's not because it necessarily looked cool, although it does look good in black and white. It's because it gave them something to do with their hands, you know? I mean, it keeps it visually interesting in a way that doesn't. And so that's removing things like that is sort of hard. And I don't want to go for the match hanging out of the mouth instead of the cigarette, although that was a really clever idea, whoever came up with that. But that's my that's my big sort of concern is where do I draw the line? It's with making the protagonists actively engage in that.
Mark, what about you guys with Pixar and Disney as co-collaborators? Are they who do you think's more touchy about the subject? Your editors or your licensee?
I think our editors are more in touch with that stuff and more touchy about it because the beauty of that license, that set of licensed properties, Toy Story, all the Pixar stuff, especially, is that even though Incredibles is a good example, and what's really kind of amazing is that movie is what, an hour 50? I mean, what is it like? You know, it's only 2 hours long, and yet those characters are so well defined in that movie, and the whole world is so well defined that instinctively, anybody who approaches those characters sort of knows where the boundaries are. And it's the same with Cars. It's the same with Toy Story. It's the same with all, like, just going in, our editors sort of have a feel for how far you can push it. And we tend to be a little conservative because we don't want to give the Pixar people anything to lose their minds about. I wish I had great, funny stories about, you know, the time that, you know, Woody had a giant chainsaw and was cutting up, and they made us stop it, but I don't. I mean, we kind of know.
I want to see that book.
Oh, now. Exactly. Toy Story XXX.
I want to know what looks away for the new Toy Story movie.
It is. Toy Story 4, Woody's Revenge. Yeah. Nightmare on Toy Story. No. Never mind. I'm not. It's. Don't let me. Somebody else jump in, please.
Go ahead.
What about as far as like Tiny Titans or Billy Batson?
No, with Tiny Titans, there's no violence or anything, and they're kids, so none of that would really apply to them. As far as Billy Batson, anything with drinking or smoking, that doesn't take place. But he's a superhero, so he punches things, and we haven't really caught any flack for that because that's what he's supposed to be doing, and. And we've gotten good feedback from people. People like the stories. People, we put different twists on things, so they like what we've been doing. And never once has an editor come to me and said, no, you can't do this, or no, you can't do that. I've never run into that with them at all.
Because it's one of the best books ever created.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'll get you your money outside. No, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks.
It's easier since Captain Marvel has a history of being
Well, you know, I've been asked that question before, which is weird. And in one of the recent books, you know, he had Mr. Mind was in his head, so he was evil, and he was a real jerk in the comic. I mean, he was like real mean to people. He pushed people over. You know, he beat up the Arson Fiend and blew up his acetylene tanks, and Arson Fiend's face melted. You know, and
this isn't in your book.
Yeah, this isn't my book.
Really?
Yeah, and you know, I'm thinking, you know, Art and I are writing this thing, and we're like, they're never gonna let this go. You know, they were fine with it because they understood that it, you know, it was part of the story, and the story was building all the way through, and we're coming to the end of that storyline, and people are really digging the story. You know, we introduced Black Adam Jr., and people are like, whoa, you know, that's never been done, and all of that is leading up to this, so they were okay with it. You know, because they knew that, you know, it was, you know, an integral part of the story. So
I think, again, not to monopolize, but I think that that first Incredibles movie helped set a tone for everything that I do, that he did, that everybody does in the superhero world of all ages comics now, because of that one amazing speech that Helen gives the kids in the cave about. It's a real world out there. You're going to get hurt. You're going to and it's something that all ages superhero stuff had never addressed that so directly and on the nose before. And it was a great speech, and it was true. I mean, this is so it sort of makes it okay then for us to walk right up to that and treat it like, well, yeah, kids. You know, if you're having kids superheroes or Billy or the kids in my book or whatever. Deal with real serious, you know, problems and real conflict, you know, there is going to be some danger. And I know I had a point, but you see what I'm saying?
No, if you act on something, if there's an action, there's a reaction, you know, and it comes back where, you know, again, referencing the book that I'm working on, Billy Batson was a real jerk when he was being taken over by Mr. Mind, that, you know, he didn't stop these fires, and one of these fires, a building collapsed, and that's how Freddie Freeman wound up in a wheelchair. You know, and then he, you know, in our story, he doesn't like Captain Marvel, so that's why he becomes Black Adam Jr. Again, it builds on the story, and again, that scene in The Incredibles, you know, it speaks the truth.
I think before that scene hit cinemas, I think that a million times I'd heard other licensors, and as an editor and as a writer, I'd heard people say, oh, you can't put kids in danger. I mean, that's, you know, you can't have anything seriously grim happen around the kids, which, you know, and licensors in particular and creators of that kind of stuff were very protective of the children characters, probably overly so, probably, because the problem there is that if there's no danger, then there's no conflict and there's no action. And I think that one speech sort of made it safe for the rest of us to, because we can always point back to them and go, look, that's the greatest, you know, all-ages superhero
it's their
of all
fault.
Time.
They did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we used to have a term that people used to use as kind of a funny term. They used to say comic book violence.
Yeah.
And then comic books, not to blame anything on the 90s, but in
right.
the 90s, comic books became a lot grittier and dirtier to a certain extent,
right.
even in the art form. Do you think that maybe the new all-ages movement, part of that is returning the superhero violence more to comic book violence instead of, hey, I need to rip this guy's spleen out sort of a thing? Do you think maybe that's part of how that shift is taking place, why
being,
it's appropriate now?
You know, being more of a superhero book with Billy Batson, I think it's just, you know, an extension of what would happen with the character. You know, I'm always going to come back and say that. It's, you know, whatever action, there's a reaction, and you know, he's a kid trying to deal with all this stuff, and sometimes bad things happen, you know. So for me, it always comes back to that.
I think there's a way to tastefully and age-appropriately handle terrible violence. I think that you can still have really bad things happening to the character and show that, you know, getting punched in the face is not a fun thing. Or, you know, getting knocked off a building, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, I think when you're referring to comic book violence, you're thinking sort of, you're talking more of the Tom and Jerry type stuff where there's no consequence.
Right.
And I think that a lot of the all ages books that I've been seeing, you do see that consequence, but it's handled in a way where in the 90s, you know, it's very graphic.
Yeah.
They're showing all of the aspects where I think that sort of stuff can happen where, you know, if somebody's, you know, getting, you know, like hit with a knife or something, then, you know, you'll see the person's back behind them and you'll see their facial expression. But you don't have to see, you know, like the knife and the blood and everything the way that you would in, you know, like, I don't know, Youngblood.
Or a horror film or something like that.
And I think that's the big difference is I think that that move away from the really from the really non-consequential violence has still happened, but I think that there's a return to trying to, or I think that there's a shift in trying to make that violence now less grim and gritty, but still a part of the narrative. Like there's still, and I think it does go back to that incredible speech. Like it's still, you know, there is going to be consequence to this stuff, but there's also a way to tastefully handle it.
There's a thing about leaving things to the imagination too, which means that, you know, what's going on in your head is probably more ghastly than what you would have drawn anyway. It's all there, you know.
My favorite letter from a kid was like a 8 or a 9 year old, and it was like, my favorite part of the book is where the mean captain gets his head cut off, which was not necessarily my intent, and you never see this. You see like a guy yelling and another guy like going up to him with a sword, and then you see like three people grimacing, and that's the extent. But
that's just where the kid took that. But
that's where
mind.
The kid took it. Yeah, I was like, wow, there you go.
Another sometimes dirty word with comics is continuity. Like with Roger, you have years and years of Muppets stories to play off of, and with Tiny Titans, a lot of time, you know, someone my age in my 30s, you know, you're making jokes that reference, you know, Wolfman and Perez's Titans, you know, something that kids will never read at this point, probably. And with Mini Marvels, you're doing the same sort of thing, is you're making jokes about characters that somebody my age, it seems like it's for me when I read it, but it's also for the age group that you're more shooting for. How do you guys handle, you know, tying those kind of things together? Does that come back to writing it for you?
Well, absolutely.
So I think there's a way of, certainly when you're writing jokes that have, you know, reference to things that are outside of a child's experience, usually, you know, what you try to do is do it on two levels, so that you've got some sort of obvious, maybe slapstick element that the kid can laugh at, and then you've got the verbal element that the adult can laugh at. So, you know, you're playing it for two audiences simultaneously. That's kind of the way I try to approach it. If I'm going to do something that's harking back to something that a kid isn't going to get, I try to have something else in that panel that the kid will get, so that they're not getting left out, you know.
In terms of strict continuity, I mean, there's... It's funny, actually. I mean, how many episodes of the original Muppet series were there? Ballpark.
I'm sure. I think there was like 5 series, right? Okay, 20 something each.
And then the movies and so forth and so on. And yet there's probably, you could probably put on one piece of paper the actual amount of continuity.
Yeah.
Right. That it's really just the consistency of knowing the characters.
It's
names,
the characters
and their
that you have to be consistent with, not the details of the stories, really.
Yeah. In Tiny Titans, we just, again, writing in that on that two level system of the Bugs Bunny, hey, it's funny when you're a kid, hey, it's funny when you're an adult. I mean, we put in ties to Blackest Night, and, you know, there's no kid in this room who's going to, well, Blackest Night, what's that? You know, the adults are like, hey, that's pretty funny. But, you know, again, putting in, you know, in panels some slapstick or something else that, you know, will help the kid get through that panel, you know, and then when they come back and read it years later after they've read Blackest Night, they're like, oh, hey, I get that now, type thing. So it's on the levels, the different levels.
I always try that when, if I'm referencing a story that's already established, I try to introduce all the things that I'm making jokes on, so that if you've never read the story that it's based on, that you have all the I'm giving you all the information you need to understand my story and to understand the jokes. And a lot of people don't realize I'm doing that because they've, like half of them have read it before, and they just assume that they have, that's their previous knowledge that makes them understand it. But my litmus test is my friends that never read comics ever, like adults that don't read comics, will still understand the stuff that I'm doing. They'll think it's funny.
Oh, it's kind of earlier.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's for Billy Batson.
Oh yeah.
Batson, I grew up reading comics, so I read a lot of my dad's really older stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I really liked was the original Captain Marvel. And
you're talking about the stuff from the 1980s or the C.C. Beck stuff from before that?
I know. I just, when you say really,
really old
stuff,
we're talking 1940s.
No, I'm just busting your shelves. I'm sorry.
I'm gonna hit you with my walker.
But recently, instead of trying to keep up with the whole continuity of the entirety DC universe, I read the novels. And I read the Infinite Crisis and Final Crisis. And I'm thinking, how old is Billy Batson right now, because he's doing stuff that no 7-year-old kid should have to go through ever,
right,
as Shazam. And then I pick up your book, and it's the same story. It's good. It's interesting. And someone my age can get it and enjoy it. And it's not gruesome, and he's not ripping people's arms off as a 7-year-old kid.
Right. Well, I mean, the beauty with the Billy Batson stuff being in, you know, the Johnny DC line as it is that we don't have any of that continuity. You know, we just started fresh from day one. You know, we followed the previous writer and we're just writing the story going ahead from there. So there's no history, there's no baggage with it. So we're just starting with a clean slate and writing what we want to write.
How old is Billy in your stories?
He's about 9 years old, 9, 10 years old. Yeah. So, and you're right, he is dealing with situations that no 10-year-old should ever have to deal with, but, you know, he's a superhero, right.
So is Harry Potter.
Yeah.
You guys are pretty lucky that you don't have to deal with a lot of the crossovers and things like that unless you want to make a joke about it. You know, obviously this would be kind of slanted, given who we have up here, but with the way that this kind of movement is going, do you think, what would you like mainstream comics to copy from you guys a little bit more? Is it content? How would you guys like to shift things more towards your line of thinking?
Clarity. I would love it if like the things that all of us do up here on this panel, if you could pick up one random comic out of the blue and enjoy it and understand it and know what's going on and know who the heroes are and know what they want and know mm-hmm. what the consequences are, and you're not coming in on chapter 12 of 14 and nobody's telling you that the craft of clarity is something that at Boom I really stress very, very strongly among our writers. And I think we do a good job of it. I think it's the single greatest barrier to people reaching a new audience. I mean, yes, we've got our iPads and we're going to be on the web and we're going to be electronic and stuff. But you know what? If that's still going to help, customers will download one issue of something that is in the mainstream continuity of comics right now, and it'll be chapter 7 of 9, and nobody will understand what's going on, and they'll never come back.
There are some. Oh, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, I disagree with you a little bit.
Please.
Because when I was a kid, I picked up, you know, an issue of Spider-Man, mm-hmm. you know, and he's fighting the tarantula on this boat, and you know he's getting scratched up and beat up, and the Punisher shows up, and I'm like, what's going on? I'm reading this, but I'm like, you know what? This is cool, and it made me go back and get other issues and follow the story.
But
so you're wrong.
No, because I had this argument with Dan DiDio all the time, because Dan always cites Avengers number 100 as his first comic, and it had every Avenger in it, and it was the last part of a story. But here's the thing, and I was the same way. I mean, believe that's how I got into comics too. I bought X-Men when I was a young kid, and then they showed up in Avengers, and I want to read this issue of Avengers. Mm. Because it has the X-Men in it, and it just blossoms out. That's how most people start to read superhero comics that become lifelong fans. But you know what? If I didn't know who these guys were, first off, it only cost me 25 cents. And secondly, if I wanted to find out more, I could go down to the drugstore or to the convenience store down the store. I could go to 100 places in town and find more. Mm. And my problem with this, with sustaining that attitude of, oh, well, you'll just want, you know, people will want to learn more. They're not going to spend $4.
Again, the flip side of that is I think that's our job as writers, is that we need to put enough elements of the story to tell you what that character's about and what he's done previously. And and then this way you'll pick it up and go, oh, okay, wait a minute. I picked up enough of the backstory. I know the character now. And what he's doing in this situation, what would he do in the next situation? What did he do previously? So I think it's a, you know, you're walking a real fine line.
I agree. I still
think you're wrong.
with serialization, I think a great example to look at is the Avatar: The Last Airbender show does a wonderful job in that it has this longer, consistent, overarching narrative. But each episode has... Right. Some sort of sub-narrative, right. And also each episode does a good job of introducing the characters.
Right.
Yeah. Usagi Yojimbo does the same thing. If Jin the Bounty Hunter comes in, or if the pickpocket comes in, they, you know, what do? The first thing, they're like, hey, it's Jim, what are you doing? He's like, I'm looking for a bounty on somebody. Right, he's a bounty hunter. Yes. Like, it's as simple as that. They get it across without ever being...
That's what our job is.
My first floppy was a two-parter Indiana Jones, but within the framework of that story, I got a whole story.
Right.
The total story isn't told, but there was some sort of consequence that was met by the end of that issue, and I think that's something you've really lost in a lot of mainstream comics.
Right.
I'll agree with you on that point. Yeah.
Oh, sure.
So you're right. You're still wrong.
I'm still wrong.
As a 35-year-old kid, mm-hmm. I kind of agree with both of you. Is I think you fall in that easy trap where, hey, we're the X-Men, and I'll call you Wolverine and say what your powers are, so that you know, and I'll harken back to this past issue so that you know what's going on. And that gets really tedious as a reader and a writer, in that I'm having to explain all this sort of thing. And it's nice sometimes to be able to pick up a book and say, hey, that's Green Lantern and the Flash, and I don't need to know anything else but that.
Yeah. Well,
and then go along for the ride.
I'm sorry. I think that our sort of DVD mentality has sort of sunk in the same way. Like, now that you can go back and watch shows from the beginning, who like starts a show with the 8th episode anymore? Like, nobody. They're like, oh, I'll wait until I can see it from the beginning
on DVD.
And I think that mentality has crept into comics as well. That you don't have to make any of the issues stand alone. You know, again, not as a complete narrative, but still as an emotionally satisfying reading experience in one sitting.
Right.
And I think that we lose that partially because that has become so ingrained throughout the culture. Throughout, we're able to access everything ever. And as a result of that, there's less inclination to make each installment self-palatable.
Mm-hmm. But in a way, they're copying the TV idea badly, because even in the TV shows that are serialized, there's always a beginning, a middle, and an end to each right. sort of unit, even though when you put them together, there's something bigger.
Which I know. But no, you're right. When I work with young writers, the one thing I insist on every single time is like, I appreciate if you're telling a 4-part story and this is part 2, I understand that. But even within the context of that, I need some conflict and some resolution. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be for the bigger picture, but I just need, you know, you don't have to solve the whole problem, but you need one, because every story is a story is when somebody wants something and something in his way. Mm-hmm. That's what a story mm-hmm. is. And I want that element in every issue, even if it's part of a bigger structure. You can always have something happen where somebody needs something and they have to overcome something to get there, even in the bigger picture. And it's easy for me to sit here and say it. It's hard to do. It actually is, and that's part
you,
of
you are not wrong.
And then they were friends again. Yeah. Well, anybody else with something different besides kind of an evergreen policy that you'd like to see tackled over from?
Yeah, I think that the mainstream comic industry really has to resolve this sort of Jekyll and Hyde thing they've got going on, where they've got these characters doing horrible things to one another in the comics, and then they've got the same characters on lunchboxes and on school bags.
Yep.
And I know that when they started doing sort of mature comics in the 80s, you know, Watchmen and all that, and Dark Knight, they were always packaged differently. The branding was different. The covers were designed differently. They were made to look completely different to the standard comics. Yeah. And now you've got that kind of content in comics that look much the same as the stuff that's been done for kids. And like, you've got a brand like Superman that's been developed for 70 years as being as safe for kids as Mickey Mouse. Yeah. And now, you know, you can't trust something with Superman on it to be for kids.
No.
So they've really got to sort that out, I think.
Yeah, I get all the DC comics for free, and I used to give comics out at Halloween. And even as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, you know, I went through the stage of, okay, now clearly I've got to go weed out a bunch of stuff. I can't just give them an indiscriminate issue of Batman or an indiscriminate issue of Superman, because I'm the creepy old single guy who lives up the street. I can't be. And now I've just given up. Now I just can't. You know what? I'll give them Boom books, but I can't go through, like, there's I don't have the time to go through the bundles of mainstream comics and find the little, you know, the ratio of appropriate to inappropriate stuff is just so high right now, or so low, whatever. I can't spend them time. Breaks my heart that I can't give a Batman comic at random to an 8-year-old kid.
Well, I found that out as a parent, again, with my kids, because I came home one day and I was like, look, we're going to watch this Green Lantern tonight, this Green Lantern movie. And I was just going on the Green Lantern comics
right.
as a kid.
Right.
And he's like, what's that word? And I'm like, you know what? Let's watch Tom and Jerry. I don't want to go there with him.
Yeah.
I'm not ready for that. And it was a good point.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I hear this word mainstream a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really sad that you have to separate it out. It's like, well, there's all ages and then there's mainstream.
Right.
One of my favorite comic books was Impulse.
Thank you.
That was an mainstream comic.
Hey.
And one of the best things about it is I could read it, and I handed it to my wife, and my wife is somebody, if I have to drag her to things,
yeah,
like this thing,
yeah,
I let her go watch Wicked. That's why I'm here. but she read it and she enjoyed it, and she's like, "Oh, this is really cool." And in fact, I brought a couple of my impulses for people to sign, and she was like, "Do they still do impulse?"
Oh, if only. No. Oh no. Oh, he is.
I sat there and tried to think. Well, what mainstream comics still have that kind of appeal? I came up empty.
I know. And by the way, I
G-Man.
You know, what's funny, actually, the horror of what we're saying starts to sink in with the repetition of the word mainstream and versus all ages. When we've completely, what have we done? We've completely flipped the paradigm. Mm-hmm. When did the word mainstream become 30,000 guys who were 28 years old? This is the thing that's maddening. Congratulations, comics. In the last 70 years, you've taken a worldwide mass medium and successfully turned it into a niche market. Well done. And then we call that mainstream, and that blows my mind. That's the opposite of mainstream.
Does it bother you, man? Various of you guys have been involved with Free Comic Book Day books.
Yeah.
And for me, Free Comic Book Day, both as a fan, as a retailer, is how many kids can we get into the store? How many comics can we get in their hands?
Right.
Does it, you know, make you smack yourself in the head with a hammer when you see that half of the Free Comic Book Day books are for leading into a crossover that a guy my age is going to be the predominant that's going to buy it, not the kids that Free Comic Book Day is for?
I mean, they're using it as an advertising thing. So, I mean, I understand it. I think the problem is when it is so... The good stores are heavily marketing these towards kids, and then you have stuff like what happened in Athens, Georgia, which is a kid walks out with like a Fantagraphic sampler with a Nick Bertozzi salon image, which is pretty innocuous if you actually read it. But the proprietor of the store is charged with distributing pornography to a minor, and was going to be put on a sex offender list, and was like facing like 11 years in jail and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's just, so there are, I know that probably makes retailers extra concerned to the point that they're.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The good retailers are the ones who, and it's a chore that they have to go through and weed out. To be fair though, Free Comic Book Day is not Free Comic Books for Kids Day.
Yeah,
it's Free Comic Book Day, and everybody, every company has a different demographic that they're targeting, and you know, the smart retailers will be the ones who will make sure, and I'm sure you do, is make sure that the age appropriate stuff gets to the age appropriate people.
Yeah. In all honesty, I didn't order those.
No, I didn't
order the ones that we couldn't just give to.
Yeah, that's
to anybody.
Probably very smart. You know your audience and you know your customer base. Yeah. Actually, this gentleman has been very patient.
Yeah. Mark, you made a really good point about a story, and he writes your point perfectly. That you have a story that is a conflict and then a resolution.
That's what a story is.
So what's your take on the never-ending crisis that Marvel and DC have been writing for the last since I don't know.
Yeah, that is an excellent question, sir. Next question, please.
They never get a break.
Talk to me when I got a bourbon in my hand.
I've seen that.
We don't have enough.
It's not pretty.
It's not pretty.
Anybody who has a thought on this?
I mean, we're in the all ages category, so speaking on DC's, not for DC, but you know, as a fan of DC. You know, what they've been doing lately, you know, with Darkest Night, you know, that was a horror story. And it had an end, you know, and the next chapter is beginning. I don't do that sort of stuff. You know, I don't do that in the books. It's more all ages content where, you know, anybody can come in, pick it up, read it, you know, and decide if they want to continue or not. So...
I think, unfortunately, the answer, as somebody who interviews those guys, the answer that you're going to get from them is when it stops selling, they'll stop doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the answer that we continuously get.
So we blame you.
Is that it sells? So
from a soap opera standpoint, too. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, like, if every single episode ends with a cliffhanger, there's a lot of people who are going to come back and pick up that next
issue. I mean, whether or not that's the way to do it, but you know, if you have that, you know, that A B thing, yeah, like so constantly going,
infinite cliffhanger.
Yeah, I mean, there are the sales reasons for it. I mean, it does make fiscal sense.
Yeah, but there's a fine line. Like the trick is, and I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong. But my feeling, I would much rather write something that makes people want to come back next month than make them feel like they're obligated to come back next month.
Yeah, I think that burns people. Well, people get fed up and they just drop everything, you know, they go cold turkey, which
well, what,
I did.
What becomes such a problem is you have, if you go in and, you know, you're, it's easier with adult books than it is with kids books, but you go in and you're like, you know, I want a Batman book. What should I start with? And they're like, I don't know, year one. They give you Batman year one. And there's a, you know, like this nice definitive standalone thing, you know, Justice League, you've got New Frontier, things like that. And to by creating that never-ending cycle, it becomes really impossible to have one, or I feel like it's much more difficult to have one project that can be used as a springboard to get people excited about characters.
I think a good example, going back to, you know, Blackest Night, is a great example of what he said. You know, look at Green Lantern before Blackest Night, you know, and look at what it's done for the character now. He's like, you know, one of the most popular characters at DC right now, and it's all because of the story leading up to that and what was going on in that book leading up to this huge storyline that everybody starts picking up and wondering what's going on, and it brings in all these other characters, and now, you know, he's one of the most popular characters there, where for a few years he just kind of, you know, was just kind of languishing.
The Blackest Night only lasts, what, 6-8 months? I mean, the X-Men have been in trouble.
No,
I know.
You know, I work for DC.
That's the thing, you know. It's just like never, sometimes they just drag something out so damn long.
I think part of it, too, is that a lot of with characters that we're talking about now, less than what a lot of these guys are doing, is with those mainstream characters, your hope is that somebody's next Spider-Man story is their first Spider-Man story. So you're setting the tone that Peter Parker, to a certain extent, is always going to exist at a level where he's, you know, having trouble holding down a job, and he's having trouble with whoever is his girlfriend.
Yeah, because we used to say that every comic is somebody's first. Sadly, now every comic is somebody's last is kind of weird. let's not forget that gentleman too when he gets, because he's been very patient as well. Yes, sir.
We've talked about comic shops. The first comics I read, I checked out from a library, and so I'm wondering what sorts of relationships or communication channels you guys have open with teachers and educators, and how children are responding to books in sort of those venues.
I do the library circuit as much as I can. I go anytime there's a library conference or a teacher conference that I'm asked to attend, I jump on it. You know, it's different from like these types of shows in that it's all out of pocket and there's no way to do it. But I feel like that'll be beneficial in the long run, because I was the same way. Like a lot of the comics that I read, I checked out of the library, and that's just becoming more and more prevalent as the graphic novel sections are growing.
Right.
Doing that, I don't know if my stuff has gotten like library awards because, and that's why I'm asked, or if it gets it because I go and they're like, hey, he, you know, gives a hoot, and they give it to me out of like some sense of nepotism. I don't really know. But either way, it works, and more libraries are checking it out, and that means that more kids are reading it, which makes me really happy.
Okay. I'm actually a grad student at SCAD.
Cool.
And I'm happy, first of all, that the library thing was brought up, because I teach cartooning at my library.
Cool.
But awesome. The question that I have is, as an all-ages group, are you seeing opportunities for an untapped market, such as tween girls, opening up through all-ages comics?
Absolutely. You know, we've been doing Tiny Titans for a number of years now. I cannot tell you how many kids, boys and girls, have come up and it's been their first comic. And, you know, we see them starting to graduate now because they're reading upper levels, you know, past that, and they're picking up, you know, the Boom Kid stuff, and they're picking up Billy Batson, and I definitely see it. I see it every convention. I definitely do.
Yeah, the tween girl the tween girls market in particular has been obviously very hard for comics to crack in the last 20 years because we catered to 40-year-olds who live in their mother's basement. So I stop using that phrase because I invented that phrase, and I should stop using it because I realize that describes Batman.
Especially while looking directly at
But yeah,
well, I think the domestically it's a lot harder. There's a lot of tween girls who are reading a lot of manga.
Yeah.
I think, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that can be a gateway to domestic
stuff as well,
which is what we want because otherwise they're not buying our stuff.
But what I was going to say was that what is pleasantly surprising to me is that we're still fine-tuning to try to figure out. But one of the things that was a gargantuan success for us in that demographic was Muppet Snow White or whatever. It was one of the Muppet, spin-off books that we did that we didn't even think about that being anything other than just an all-ages kid stuff. And, man, the number of 11, 12, 13-year-old girls who stampeded these booths at the convention to get that stuff, I was flabbergasted and quite pleased. And so we're still trying to feel around. Like, how do we does that mean we can use Muppets as more of a gateway for that sort of thing? And then will that lead us to be able to do other stuff? I don't know.
I think all of you guys are in a very unique position too, that you can have, that you can be crossover to people who it is going to be their first comics or can get them interested in comics, and then a lot of other people can't because they're tied to some of the other things we've discussed.
Right.
A funny story about Chris's comics is I was sitting in my office at the shop playing Space Invaders, I think, on your website with your characters.
Right.
And one of my customers walked in and started asking questions about this. Is this comic about them fighting Space Invaders? Or I was like, no, but that got her to read the G-Man miniseries. So you never know what kind of tie-in you're going to have with something if you do something a little different.
Muppet Space Invaders. Got it. All right. Awesome.
Hi, I've been collecting since 1959, so I was buying comic books in candy stores. And I don't want to run this into the ground. I'm a professor of literature at our local college. And when you talk about mainstream, are you in...
Continuity-based superhero comics,
I think. They've got the Marvel Universe and DC Universe books, basically.
What are your sales compared to... What are the sales for what you're doing compared to what you're calling mainstream?
Oh, catastrophic. By the way... by the way, first off, you have to explain to everybody in this room what a candy store is.
true, probably, but...
He'd put a nickel in the jukebox.
As the market has collapsed down to being a small group of people who are really buying these things, has your sort of market, which would have been in the old days...
It would have been the predominant market. That would have been because Walt Disney Comics and Stories was the best-selling comic book of all time forever.
Mm-hmm. And the Marvel Adventures was the best-selling
proportionately with theirs?
Sorry?
Your market has shrunk proportionately, so you are a smaller market than what we call mainstream now?
Oh, God, yes. Because our only... outlet for distribution by and large up here up until the magic of the electronic age, thank God, which is the new newsstand, our market has been 3,000 comic shops scattered randomly across the United States that cater to guys who are in their 30s.
You have to walk past the pornography section to get to the kids section in my local comics.
I think it's changing a little bit. Uh-huh. Also, I mean, again, not tooting my own horn, but having Tiny Titans come out and being a success with kids and new kids coming every day and picking it up, winning an award, getting on the New York Times bestsellers, opened the door to getting that in bookstores.
Yeah.
When I walk into Walden Books and Barnes & Noble, I see Tiny Titans. I go in and take it off the back shelf and put it in the front.
Right.
Because that's me. But I see it there more and more, and it's a place where I haven't seen comics like that in a long time. And it's exciting for me, to go in and see kids' books, at kid eye level sections when you walk into the kids section in the back.
And nowadays trades are really important for the industry. I mean, we all love comic shops. I get my paycheck from one currently, but being able to expand past the direct market with libraries and being able to expand into bookstores is creating more readers.
Grocery store point of purchase stuff. I feel like that's and everybody disagrees with me is like
well, that's how Archie's
go back to slave
sustained an audience for decades.
I know, but I mean, it seems like and it seems especially like some of the franchise property thing. I mean, Disney. Well, but Disney Adventures didn't do that well. I mean,
they did really well.
It wasn't counting for economic reasons.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
Here, but no. I don't talk about it here, but we'll talk after. I've learned the labyrinth of.
I know that it's a logistical nightmare and that with everything.
It's not even that, and it's actually much cheaper to do than you would think it is to do. But there are other. We'll talk.
Okay.
Did you have? I'm sorry. I feel like we cut you off. Did you have a follow up question or no? Okay, good. Just want to make sure we got you covered.
Well, my question had a little bit to do with the economy of you know making comic books and who's going to get bought and who's going to get asked to do more because. It seems that everyone reads that rated R movies or more violent movies actually never make as much money as the PG-13 or lower movies. Mm-hmm. And since, and I know that we've done away with the rating system as far as comic books go, but everyone knows, like Wolverine stabs people. Mm-hmm. His only power is to stab someone.
Sure.
I mean, you know, Superman can flick a guy or punch him. Oh, he's just sleeping.
Right.
But why is it so hard to win that battle. If you've got these, you know, you have all the examples of people actually want this, why is it somehow hard to tell a producer, well actually, you're wrong, sir. I mean, I realize that producers hold the cards. I've probably answered my own question. But it just seems like it's an uphill fight to say, you know, PG-13 and lower is what we really should all be aiming for. And yet everyone's just like, rated R, guys, let's just get more violent. From your perspective, how do you guys fight with that, battle with it?
You know, I think a lot of these kids' movies that were coming out prior to the Pixar stuff, I'll go that route, were either hit or miss. And, you know, there's no other real entertainment, so kids would be dragged to these things by parents because, oh, it's rated G or whatever. You know, I go into Pixar movies and, you know, I watch Up, you know, and I'm like watching this movie going, look, kids, your dreams are going to be not coming true for a real long time, and then you know people are going to die, and you know, but then at the end, I'm like, this is a great movie. Yeah. You know, it's just I've always been a fan of tell a great story, people will find you, and that's always what we've tried to do. Even when we were doing independent stuff, we got into mainstream comics, DC and Marvel, or we got into DC because of the stuff we were doing in our independent book. And people notice that. You know, if you go back to my origins when I was doing, you know, small independent books, I was dropped by the distributor. And I was given a letter saying, we will never carry any of your books ever again. I'm like, really? You know? And then, you know, I get this letter from Diamond that says, we're never going to carry your stuff ever again.
Did you, like, dump his sister or something? I'm like, what does this mean?
Sales aren't good. Yeah. Your sales aren't good, and then we came out with Patrick the Wolf Boy, and it really struck a chord with people. People thought it was funny, and that led to us getting the job at DC. You know, I didn't do anything different now, or I don't do anything different now for DC than I did when I was doing my independent stuff. I'm looking to tell a good story, and people like it, and if that's what I'm trying to do.
I think with the Marvel and DC Universe stuff these days, the audience is kind of hooked on shock. Because there's not a lot left for them to get worked up about. Because their emotional investment in the characters, for a lot of them, isn't there anymore, I think. Because they're not the characters I grew up with. The shock is all that's left, really.
Well, I mean, my sales have changed. I mean, I come to these shows because I know that you guys have your own side projects. Most likely, there's the one spot that I can find. And I think that the shock value is over for me. I like wit, and I like, you know, solid, good humor.
Those are harder to write.
Yeah.
That's a big part of it, I think.
And so I find myself having to work more, and yet, you know, I guess I'm tired of hearing that, you know, everyone's tired of, you know, this senseless violence, but I'm tired of it. And yet they're like, oh, we're going to have six more of whatever.
That's, well, again, like I said, but it sells, unfortunately, to an ever-dwindling base.
Yeah.
And also, there are a lot of fine people in comics, but there are a lot of really lazy, short-sighted people, too.
Yeah.
who just say, you know what, at the end, I just have him beat somebody to death with his own arms. Just do that.
And it really does. As somebody that sells books and talks to people who sells books, and when you ask the questions that, you know, man, I know a lot of people that are tired of this. People keep telling me. And they'll say, well, you know what, that's what's selling. And coming into as a retailer, you know, I wish that, you know, the Muppets and Tiny Titans sold as many copies as, you know, Final Crisis and Blackest Night did, but it's not even close. Yeah. So the best...
Vote with your dollars, guys. Vote with your dollars.
You have to vote with your pocketbooks, and when you recommend something, you have to recommend, you know, what you really like to other people to get other people to... And one thing that I say about that is that all of these guys' books are more affordable.
Yeah.
The all ages books are more affordable right now than the other books. So
I think what's going to flip the paradigm finally, and you, the retailer, are not going to hear this, but I think iPad, iPhone, electronic distribution is going to finally flip that paradigm, because once we start making real inroads in electronic publishing with comics, the comics that people are going to keep coming back to, not the customers we have now, but the customers we want to reach, the ones they're going to want to come back to are the ones that they can understand and comprehend, and that's what we do well. And so guess what? I think you're going to, you know, in a perfect world, I think, you know, 2-3 years from now, you'll see the paradigm flipped where maybe we will see the end of the ever dwindling spiral of people who just read things that are crisis or, you know, Civil War branded or whatever. I don't know.
We're running out of time, so this will be our last question.
Well, since they're asleep and distracted, I'm going to make fun of them. I have a 14-year-old who didn't read books until Twilight.
Yeah.
I've got a 12-year-old who's really into manga, and this one will, anything where there's lots of Hulk smash in it, she'll read.
Awesome.
Any suggestions for what I can get?
Have you checked out Raina Telgemeier's table yet?
Sorry?
Raina Telgemeier?
Yeah.
Basically, any of the books we do, you should get.
I'm trying to figure out what's a good, especially for, I'm glad you asked the tween girl.
Yeah.
What's a good jumping point for them? I mean, I know what I like, and it was easy, you know.
I think, honestly, you just answered your own question. You know what you like. How did you find out what you like? I think they need to go through the same process and find what they like. I think they really like
G-Man.
there's this idea that we have to wean like manga kids off of manga and to American comics, and I don't think that's the case. I think there's a lot of really good manga, and it's so much more affordable per.
But then if it choose, they can have both. They're allowed to have both.
Yeah, they are allowed. They are allowed to have both. But I know a lot of people that are comic fans that are like, my kid reads a lot of manga. What can I do to get him to, you know, like Spider-Man? I was like, that's not necessarily going to happen. I think the fact that they're reading these comics are going to make them open to good comics of other stuff. And I think it's just putting them in a position where they're able to access this stuff. There's a lot of, I think, really sort of, I guess like Huckster making money off of the Twilight fans, like, you know, sexy teen vampire comics out there. But I don't think any of them will resonate the way that book probably does with your oldest. I think that probably finding what it is about that particular story. What is it about that story that you like? Is it the vampires? Is it the drama? It's the vampires. There's other vampire stuff. If it's like, it may not be the vampires themselves. It may be the fact that it's these sort of forbidden loners that are, you know, separate from society, and like dating them is dangerous and stuff like that. And therefore you can find a lot of other stuff with that same sort of emotional resonance. And actually a lot of the sort of the teen X titles might fall into that category. Things like Runaways and stuff like that. So finding what, I haven't read Runaways, but I assume it's same as Twilight. But I think finding that finding whatever that emotional core is, not necessarily the subject matter, but what it is about that subject matter that's attractive. That's the best way to find new stuff, I think.
I'm gonna go with G-Man.
What? Yeah, G-Man.
G-Man's a vampire now, right?
He is now.
Everybody, a round of applause for all the questions and our guests. Thanks everybody for coming out.
Thank you.
D-Man.
Thank you.
That was fun. Thanks. All right, that was good. Thanks so much.